The Beat Podcast is brought to you by Nutritia and is designed for healthcare professionals only. This episode is specifically for healthcare professionals with an interest in inherited metabolic conditions. Asking the questions in this episode is Dr. James Nurse, a consultant paediatrician.
Well, excellent. Well, hello. Welcome to this metabolic podcast brought to you from Nutritia. I'm your host, James Nurse, a consultant paediatrician interested in inherited metabolic disease and medical education. Throughout this series, I'm hoping we can all learn a little bit more about the sometimes complicated, sometimes extremely complicated world of metabolic medicine. We're beginning the series with a focus on the people delivering the service, the members of the metabolic multidisciplinary team. And in today's episode, I'm joined by the inimitable Suzanne Ford, a specialist dietitian who, in addition to her NHS role, also works with the National Society for Phenylketonuria, the NSPKU, a dietitian plus, if you will. Suzanne, thank you for speaking with me.
Thanks for having me. Thank you to Nutritia as well.
So obviously this is both a bit new to the both of us, but I wonder if you could start by telling us all a bit about yourself and why you chose to work in metabolic medicine.
Right. Well, I qualified as a dietitian over 25 years ago. And after a month's locuming, my first job was a rotational job at Guy's and St. Thomas's Trust. And there was a metabolic dietitian there called Kathy. I do remember clearly that she got 100% job satisfaction from her role. It was really evident. I did other job roles in the interim. And some were very education based, and there was some very junior management roles before I got the chance to work with adults who have a metabolic disorder, which is at North Bristol NHS Trust, and I still do that job.
So would you say that you chose metabolic medicine, or did it sort of choose you?
Oh, I most definitely chose to work with people with PKU and metabolic disorders. So I know that the families and the patients didn't choose it, of course. Absolutely a conscious decision on my part.
Obviously, they're a wonderful group of families to work with. You've now ended up working with adults in North Bristol. What kind of training did you need to get to where you are?
Well, I quite like studying, so I have gained a couple of qualifications since I started out as a dietitian. What really helped me was doing a master's module in metabolic dietetics, and this is called Module 4. That was 13 years ago. It was incredibly useful. I had Professor Anita McDonald marking my essays, and I really hope that my writing has improved since then. The training in this is so important. It is on my to-do list, actually, to work with my professional body, the British Dietetic Association, to develop a master's module for metabolic dietetics in adults. I think that it's something we need to take forward to recognise adult metabolic dietetics as a speciality in its own right.
Yeah, man, I know it's something that there's certainly been identified work that adult metabolic medicine still sits under a women's and children's health umbrella. So it's obviously a work in progress. So from there, how did you start working with the NSPKU?
Well, there were two standout patients in clinic who really impacted on me and made me want to work more closely with the PKU community. I mean, these two are still my patients, and I constantly learn from them and from all the other patients in clinic. And it was relating really to the very open and honest interactions I've had with my patients, which just shows how impactful being diagnosed with a rare inherited metabolic disorder can be, and also just how impactful a lifelong dietary regimen can be on every aspect of people's lives, from their feelings towards a food or foods that they will never ever taste, right through to their personal aspirations and personal fulfillment around having a family of their own. So that's really what made me want to work more with people with PKU and the NSPKU.
Oh, it's such a privilege as a clinician to be involved in these families from, you know, almost the moment their baby's born, or certainly in the first 2 weeks of life, and then knowing them until adulthood. The NSPKU itself, it's not a new charity, is it?
Good point. Yes, it was formed in 1973, and I am the fourth dietitian for NSPKU. I need to say that only as recently as 20 years ago, there were just 14 dietitians working with metabolic patients in the UK. So, I mean, 14 dietitians is that was it in this speciality. And the NSPKU became, and it still is, an essential source of information about the low protein diet. And I must say that the website has masses of resources on it. So that's www.nspku.org. And they're not just produced by me, but they are produced by a small team of dietitians, the medical advisory panel for NSPKU. And I joined in 2017, which was the year that the European guidelines on the diagnosis and management of PKU were published. And since then, the NSPKU has been campaigning really hard on different aspects of the guidelines and on how current services compare to the guidelines. The NSPKU is just 2 years from its 50th birthday, and it's a really very active organisation, considering that there's just three part-time staff and everybody else is a volunteer.
They need to do so much. I can't believe there's only three part-time staff. You mentioned the website. The thing I love is when you're on Twitter, they're always putting out suggestions for this is what you can have at Christmas, this is what you can have at Easter, this is what you can have at Halloween. I think it's an incredible resource for the members.
Yes, I agree. And I can only really thank the dietitians that volunteer to help me with that, because a lot of that comes from other people, such as the Birmingham team of dietitians and Professor McDonald. Yeah.
And I think our listeners are probably aware of some of the day-to-day responsibilities of a metabolic dietitian, or, you know, some of them will be, I hope. However, you're unique in that you're also a dietitian who works for this prominent national charity. Obviously, we're hoping that by sharing your experiences that others can learn from that and maybe inspire other people to do some more, to do work with other patients that are facing organisations. What does an NSPKU dietitian actually do?
Right. Well, a large amount of my time is managing the NSPKU helpline. So this helpline is accessible to patients and healthcare professionals. The complexity of the PKU diet has really evolved over the last 40 to 50 years. And the details have really only just been agreed by specialists because of the food labelling law changes and the time commitment that's needed for the successful management of a low protein diet is really considerable. So it's been measured at an average of 19 hours per week. And that is equivalent to a part-time job. So that time investment is needed just to keep someone with PKU well and functional. So you can imagine that there are quite a lot of queries to the helpline around the diet. It really is so complex. And the helpline isn't just for our members, it is for anybody. Phenylketonuria has an incidence of about 1 in 10,000, and we believe there may be about 6,000 people living with PKU in the UK. And this call frequency, the contacts to the helpline, can really vary depending on what's new, what's going on in the world, such as the pandemic. And the pandemic has resulted in the call volume being tripled. So I would really like to get permission in the future from the helpline callers to publish themes on what the unmet needs are as they're represented by helpline calls. Obviously, this would be anonymous. I think there are some people who are contacting us who've got very complicated medical history, people who are struggling to follow the low protein diet, perhaps due to neurocognitive complications of PKU. people who are not on diet for various reasons.
You mentioned that you wanted to sort of consider publishing the themes from the calls. You talked about publications. I think what's interesting about the NSPKU is you're looking at publishing work that is initiated by the patients, whilst I think there's a trend in medical publishing to have work initiated by clinical and scientific teams. What have the NSPKU done in this area that you can share?
Yes, I think we're very proud of this, the NSPKU and the patient community. So perhaps up till recently, the patient experience hasn't been thoroughly understood. And the NSPKU ran a large survey in winter 2017-18, and we did publish this. We actually published it across two papers. I need to say that the teamwork involved in this is quite considerable, so it isn't just me. And the patient community themselves were really committed to completing this survey in really sort of frank, open and honest ways. So they really got involved in the participation of the survey. The object of the survey is just gaining in-depth insights into the challenges of living with this disorder and how it's managed through diet. I think we achieved that goal. We learned a great deal. What we learned is that of our 632 patients responded, a quarter do not manage to take the protein substitutes prescribed to them, the whole dose. One-sixth of adults who responded are unable to manage the diet by themselves. And generally just the sense that this is a fragile situation for many people. As a result, there could be some suboptimal outcomes for this community. And when we asked for, we were asked about experiences in education, for instance, more than a quarter of the children whose carers filled the survey out, more than a quarter had educational difficulties at school. And the same proportion of adult respondents had difficulties obtaining qualifications or with their career progression. So I think we can see a large percentage of the patient community is struggling still with the diet and with outcomes that are linked to neurocognition.
You mentioned that this community struggles with the PKU diet. Do you know what influences that?
Well, yeah, so the NSPKU wanted to further dive into this. And so we've done another open access publication specifically looking at prescriptions and access to diet. We had 250 responses to this particular survey, and we found almost half the respondents reported prescription delays or obstruction to diet, which really results in a concerning level of disruption and food insecurity for patients. And as you know, diet disruption for children and for pregnant women can have irreversible results on, well, on their brain development for either the individual patient or in the case of the woman who's pregnant, for their offspring. And I see it as my job to support patients by raising awareness of these risks. And I suppose I'm appealing particularly perhaps to prescribing support dietitians and medicines optimization pharmacists and teams. If you're listening to this, please, please understand that this group is very vulnerable. They need understanding and support. So, I mean, it's my role, and I'm supported by dietitians volunteering on the NSPKU medical advisory panel with this. It's my role to promote the BIMDG metabolic dietetic formulary. And it could be used by medicines optimizations teams. So you can double check on prescribing requests and get really authoritative and trusted information about prescribed items that PKU patients request or dietitians request for them. And it's, so that's on this website. And I really think it's important to remove all barriers to prescriptions for PKU patients so we can get metabolic stability and no diet interruptions. It is also my job to develop innovative thoughts about the future abilities for metabolic dietitians to prescribe and oversee metabolic prescriptions, and that would be both for protein substitutes and for low protein foods for PKU patients.
And it's a difficult job for the medicines optimization teams in GP surgeries and the commissioning groups where they're looking to reduce their sort of global expenditure. And I think they're not necessarily very well suited to sort of these very rare diseases where they're trying to sort of say certain products are like for like the same, when quite clearly our patients have such very specific needs and in the, you know, and what they're used to and what they like the taste of, which is such an important thing with the diet we're asking of them. You mentioned the importance of staying on diet for pregnant women. Has there been any specific research around this group? I've certainly seen case reports.
Yes, I think there's much more to find out about supporting pregnancy in PKU and supporting our female patients with PKU to have good experiences in having their children. We do have some preliminary information in the public realm. So the survey I mentioned before revealed that women were actually very fearful of unplanned pregnancies to the point that some had avoided sexual relationships completely and found this topic quite difficult to discuss with their metabolic team. And other women who have had children said the pregnancies were very stressful, ultimately made more difficult because of their PKU. Half of the women had been pregnant, had reported depression following the pregnancy. And in the majority of cases, they didn't have enough support from their metabolic teams once they'd given birth. And they frequently described that it was really very challenging to devote themselves to a newborn baby and to carry on their own dietetic needs. So they couldn't follow the low protein diet after they'd given birth. So, I mean, anecdotally, I think the practice has changed following this publication. And metabolic teams who work with adult women, I think they have noted these findings, but, you know, we're trying to offer more support and closer monitoring of women after they've given birth. But there's more research that's needed, yes.
And you're talking there about the more research being needed. In particular, what do you think are the areas that should be targeted for more study?
Well, I think the idea of the first 1,000 days, this is considered the crucial window of time to influence the future health outcomes of an individual. The first 1,000 days of the offspring of our female patients with PKU isn't something that we perhaps have thought enough about. So, for example, are we optimizing breastfeeding in this patient group? And there isn't any published evidence about this to my knowledge. So I do think that more work can be done to support women postpartum, to support dietary adherence, and to support mental health as well.
And so that's the first 1,000 days for an infant born to a mother with PKU. And the question about breastfeeding is how we support a mother with PKU to breastfeed a sort of a non-PKU baby, if you will.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And so that has the breastfeeding is going to have health outcomes results for both the individual baby and the individual mum in terms of weight management and so on for her, and in terms of all the benefits that we know there are for breastfeeding.
We know that there's this funny phenomena in pregnancy where mums with PKU who are pregnant with a fetus that does not have PKU have increased feed tolerance in pregnancy. Do we know what the breastfeeding does to a mum's phenylalanine tolerance? Is it unaffected, or do their protein requirements go up? What happens?
Oh, yes, that's a fascinating question. Well, they kind of, in my experience clinically, it's a midway point of tolerance between the preconception fee tolerance and the fee tolerance at full term. So it's somewhere midway between those two. But it, as the baby that's breastfeeding starts to take up more breast milk as it grows, then you might get another climb in Phe tolerance as breastfeeding progresses. And then as the baby's weaned but still feeds, you get a little drop off.
Well, I mean, we know that obviously variability in Phe levels also greatly enhances, affects emotional state as well. Certainly, that's when we see report in the patient community, and we know that in a postpartum mum, the emotional state can be highly fluctuant as well. So it must be an incredibly challenging time for these families.
Yes, it really, really is, and I think that that's why we need to do a bit more research into this, because the first few days immediately postpartum are pretty crucial for mum and baby during this time. Like you say, stability, Phe stability, as much support for mental well-being and feeling that you can manage your diet. I think these are all crucial. Yeah, there's a lot of work to do.
And when we're talking about the work that needs to be done, we know that PKU is really a relatively recently recognised disease. The development of dietetic therapy happened within the lifetime of some clinicians looking after these patients. What does this mean for our understanding of the impact of the condition in adults? You're an adult dietitian. What is it you're seeing in this patient group, and what can you tell them to expect going forward?
Oh, yes. Well, this is fascinating because, of course, newborn screening only started 51 years ago. So we can't really say what the clinical issues will be for our patients in clinic. People who are diagnosed early and have continuously been managed on their low protein diet, we don't know what clinical features we'll see as they age. There are many patients who are diagnosed at a later stage in life, and they're struggling with their neurological complications of PKU, and there are patients who are diagnosed early but have been managed intermittently and may be struggling because of that. So we've got a very mixed group of patients. This is the unknown aspect of the PKU patient community in the UK. It could be that as many as 3,000 of either 3,000 patients have either never been diagnosed or they've been lost to follow up since childhood or since adulthood. So it's a big task is to ensure really that we follow the European guidelines on the diagnosis and management of PKU, which recommends all patients with PKU should be under metabolic follow up, if only to just assess them clinically and have nutritional biochemistry on these patients. So there's quite a lot of work to do with this. I'm going to put another appeal out to the listeners. If anyone has patients who have PKU and using your services but not under specialist follow-up, then please discuss this with them and encourage them to find a PKU clinic, if you like.
Why is it so important these patients are under a specialist service?
We know that people with highly modified diet are at increased risk of developing insulin resistance and dyslipidemia and perhaps an increased risk of cardiac disease. And we are also learning more and more, for instance, about the gut microbiome of people on a PKU diet. It's quite different to those on a standard Western omnivorous diet. So listeners might be aware of various emerging associations of certain long-term health conditions with the gut microbiome. So that's obesity and diabetes, but also mental health problems. And I think this is another sort of interesting future research topic. There's a lot to study and a lot of work to do.
And we know that certainly it's a bit of a vicious cycle. If you're off diet, your Phe is up, makes it harder to plan the diet and engage with services. Finding these lost to follow-up patients, it's not going to be easy, is it?
Agreed. No, it's not going to be. I'm briefly want to mention here, actually, somebody else's work, if I may. And that is Mary Bithell, who is the director of I think we would say NCARDAS, the National Congenital and Rare Diseases Registry at Public Health England. And she has started working on a PKU registry in England. And Mary and her colleagues will have information eventually on all PKU patients in England. And we might refer to this register as like big data, if you like. And I think that we will get some really good information from it.
So it's worth noting, you can't ignore it at the moment. We're recording this in the midst of a global pandemic. It would be lovely if you and I were together, but we're not. I think normally we meet over coffee and biscuits at a conference, and now we're meeting over a Zoom call. This has obviously been hugely disruptive around the provision of routine services within the NHS, but it's also driven some rapid innovation too. Is that something that you've found for your patients?
Absolutely, yes. So we're using video calls, which would have been a sort of maybe a little bit of a fantasy before, and it's become a real, an essential reality. The NSPKU really want to find out about what the PKU community think of video conference appointments, remote consultations, but also we want to generally consider the pathway of care that families experience from diagnosis through to transition to adult services. So we will be surveying the patient community in the coming weeks and months, just to find out what good practice is out there and how this impacts on patient engagement, and what practices can really best support adherence to this complex diet.
It certainly seems it's the NSPKU is a small charity, but really quite big plans. It strikes me that it must be really hard to serve what is a very small population, up to 6,000 people at most in a country of 70 million, with a condition that everyone is tested for, but most have never heard of. But, and also there are so many unmet needs.
Yes. Crowdsourcing. Well, we like to have a social media presence, I think you might know. And we do try to make our voice heard. So using websites, social media, getting detailed information to people in a variety of ways, but that's effective, is vital. So we use every kind of resource that we can.
I mean, I honestly don't know how you do a regular job and you do this, and you still find time for your dog, who's rather special too.
Yes. So a very brief shout out to Millie the Wonder Dog. This might seem a strange topic for a metabolic podcast, but some listeners already know that not only is Millie the Labrador the official NSPKU Society dog, and she does have a key role actually in engagement of people and promoting participation in surveys. Her photograph is often on Twitter and gets lots of hits. She does have her very own metabolic disorder, as she has Wilson's disease, which is an inherited disorder of copper metabolism, and she may well have copper deposits in various tissues.
I don't want to keep you from Millie much longer. We've obviously heard her jingling around in the background today. Before we finish, I wanted to ask, if you met your younger self, I suppose you must meet lots of young dietitians coming through, and are you a keen advocate of training and mentoring, what piece of advice would you give your younger self?
I think enthusiasm and commitment and being part of a team are probably quite key to being able to do a task or a job, keeping the patient in mind as well. And I think those factors can influence and help you achieve tasks that you more than you might think possible. I think that's probably what I'd say to my younger self.
Well, thank you. We've obviously spoken on, you know, numerous occasions. I really had, you know, hadn't the first job, you know, hadn't the first notion of just quite how much you do. I'm absolutely in awe that you find the time to fit it all in.
Thank you. And before I go, I have two special requests. Firstly, the NSPKU Twitter account. I am always keen for more followers. So if you are involved in the PKU world or want to know more about a low protein diet, look for me on NSPKU. I do post most days. And anybody who's keen for new challenges in 2021, if you want to fundraise for a charity, please consider us. And finally, anybody with any queries about PKU, please do contact me. There's contact through our website or Twitter or even by the phone. And thank you very much to Nutricia for inviting me. Thank you, James.
Thank you so much for making the time to speak to me today. It's always good to understand the work of our colleagues a little bit better. And I hope that those listening at home will have enjoyed it. And if they want to know more about the other members of the MDT, then I hope they'll check out the other episodes of this new podcast series, where we'll be speaking to research dietitians, clinical psychologists, and more. Suzanne, thank you again for speaking with me. Thank you for listening. Until next time, goodbye.
To keep up to date with future episodes of the Beat podcast from Nutricia, make sure you subscribe on whichever platform you listen to your podcasts on. For more updates on the show, as well as lots of other educational content from Nutricia, sign up to our newsletter at www.nutricia.co.uk. Thank you.